Progressive Radio Network. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
You're listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm on the road, not in the studio, so I just want to let you know that the technical quality may not be what it normally is, but the information will be. Today, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, the politics behind the U.S. empire and its consequences for American citizens. My guest, Professor James Petras. Professor Petras is the Bartol Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University in New York. He's an expert in America's interference in global politics, especially Latin America and the Middle East. He has a long commitment to social justice issues and workers' rights, and was a member of the Bertrand Russell Tribunal on Repression in Latin America. He is also the recipient of many awards, including the Distinguished Service Award from the American Sociological Association, and the Robert Kinney Award. He's written over 60 books in 29 languages, published over 600 articles in professional journals. His editorials in major news publications like the New York Times, The Nation, The Guardian, La Mode, and several Latin American publications, and he has been read by millions of people. His most recent book is The Politics of Empire, the U.S., Israel, and the Middle East. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. I've been looking forward to this.
I invited you back for a full program because during our last conversation, we never had a chance to take a hard look at the aggressive roles of the United States and Israel in the Middle East and the many ways that our presence there is completely disrupting and destabilizing the region. I have two immediate questions regarding Israel at this moment. A couple of weeks ago, we witnessed the theatrical play in the Congress with Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu addressing, or better, lecturing our legislators. As the independent media has accurately reported, there was nothing new in his speech. Netanyahu has been raising alarm with our country about Iran, which has more in common with the Bush administration's claims about Saddam Hussein's possession of weapons of mass destruction a decade ago. However, behind Netanyahu's speech before Congress, we can observe the degree to which the U.S. government bends over backwards to Israel's demands, protects it from war crimes and crimes against humanity, and continues to donate huge amounts of money, over $3 billion a year, plus weapons to its military. So, is it fair to ask the question, who wags whose tail? And how has Israel managed to control the U.S. Congress and the U.S. media, even independents like Bernie Sanders or the new Love Fest with Elizabeth Warren on the left? They still line up right behind Israel. So much of the world was aghast because it was expecting his Likud party to lose because non-Jews account for about 50% of Israel's population, and a large segment of the Jewish population have turned against Netanyahu. So how do you account for his victory?
Well, I think there's a material basis. It isn't just his racism and his hostility to the United States. I think the deeper issue is that Israeli colonialism, and particularly their grabbing land in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, has benefited over a half a million Jews. They've gotten free housing, air conditioning, swimming pools, million-dollar community centers on lands that have been usurped over the years, but particularly during Netanyahu's terms of office. If you look at the two, he's been in office longer than any prime minister in the history of Israel. He keeps getting elected over and over again. And the reason is because so many Jews that were fighting issues of housing and the high rents and difficulty of meeting payments because of the growth of real estate speculation. Here is Netanyahu offering them a solution. Settle on Palestinian land, set up an outpost, and I will back you with the Israeli Defense Force, which isn't a defense force, it's an offensive force. And if any Arab shepherd has his sheep grazing someplace choice land or there's some olive trees, we'll tear them down and we'll make sure that none of these century-long residential communities cease to exist. The Israeli government under Netanyahu annually spends about $260 million financing these new settlements. And as I said, it's been growing 5% a year, every year of Netanyahu's prime ministership. That's the key. Jews-only communities, Jews-only financing, Jews being the beneficiary of Palestinian land and Israeli home building. That's a material basis why large numbers of religious and non-religious Jews support them. And in Jerusalem, particularly in the settlements and takeovers in East Jerusalem where the glittering condos are going up, that's another stronghold for Netanyahu's voting base. So people can say what they want. But when Netanyahu says there's never going to be a two-state solution, that is a guarantee for these settlers and these new housing and towns that they're not going to be forced out in any settlement. And when Netanyahu says Jerusalem will be the undivided capital of a Jewish Israel, he's talking to precisely these people who have seized properties in the East Jerusalem area. He's giving them guarantees what they have now. And there is another element here, and that is people that are in the housing bind today, they're looking around, how do we get into low-income, high affluent housing? And Netanyahu says, don't protest. We'll just seize some more Palestinian land. So it's not only the 600,000 households that have received land over the years, it's those hundreds of thousands who are protesting over housing but have the promise from Netanyahu, who says he's going to continue to build new Jewish towns in new areas for the future. So there's several hundred thousand more Jewish voters who can look forward to free housing in the future. And I think this is a much overlooked issue. There's secular and religious Jews, Ashkenazis and Sephardics. There are upper class, middle class, and lower class Jews involved in this in one way or another. So I think this is really what is at stake. And as a settler population, they depend on Netanyahu, and Netanyahu depends on them. And that's why he keeps winning election after election.
I'd like to read a letter now from Albert Einstein. I don't think anyone in this audience needs to be reminded about Albert Einstein, but this is a letter that was sent to the New York Times in 1948, protesting the visit of Menachem Begin And I'll quote it. It's December 4th, 1948, the New York Times. And interesting, I didn't see any media at all refer to this letter. Possibly people had forgotten it. It was so long ago. Quote, among the most disturbing political phenomena of our times is the emergence in the newly created state of Israel of the Freedom Party, a political party closely akin in its organization, methods, and political philosophy and social appeal to the fascist parties. It was formed out of the membership and following of the former LUMI, a terrorist right-wing chauvinist organization in Palestine. The current visit of Menachem Begin, the leader of this party, to the United States is obviously calculated to give the impression of American support for his party in the coming Israeli elections and to cement political ties with conservative Zionist elements in the United States. Several Americans of national repute have lent their names to welcome his visit. It is inconceivable that those who oppose fascism throughout the world, if correctly informed as to Mr. Begin's political record and perspectives, could add their names in support to the movement he represents. Before irreparable damage is done by way of financial contributions, public manifestations in Begin's behalf and the creation in Palestine of the impression that a large segment of America supports fascist elements in Israel, the American public must be informed as to the record and objectives of Mr. Begin and his movement. The public avowals of Begin's party are no guide whatsoever to its actual character. Today, we speak of freedom, democracy, and anti-imperialism, whereas until recently, they openly preached the doctrine of the fascist state. It is in its actions that the terrorist party betrays its real character. From its past actions, we can judge what it may be expected to do in the future. A shocking example was their behavior in the Arab village of Deir Yassin. This village, off the main roads and surrounded by Jewish lands, had taken no part in the war, had even fought off Arab bands who wanted to use the village as their base. On April 9th, the New York Times reported, terrorist bands attacked this peaceful village, which was not a military objective in the fighting, killed most of its inhabitants, 220 men, women, and children, and kept a few of them alive to parade as captives through the streets of Jerusalem. Most of the Jewish community was horrified at the deed, and the Jewish agency sent a telegram of apology to King Abdullah of Transjordan. But the terrorists, far from being ashamed of their act, were proud of this massacre, publicized it widely, and invited all the foreign correspondents present in the country to view the heaped corpses and general havoc of the town. The town incident exemplifies the character and actions of the Freedom Party. Within the Jewish community, they have preached an admixture of ultranationalism, religious mysticism, and racial superiority. Like other fascist parties, they have been used to break strikes and have themselves pressed for the destruction of the free trade unions. In their stead, they have proposed corporate unions on the Italian fascist model. During the last years of sporadic anti-British violence, the IZL and Stern groups inaugurated a reign of terror in the Palestinian Jewish community. Teachers were beaten up for speaking against them. Adults were shot for not letting their children join them. By gangster methods, beatings, window smashings, and widespread robberies, the terrorists intimidated the population and exacted a heavy tribute. The people of the Freedom Party have had no part in the constructive achievements in Palestine. They have reclaimed no land, built no settlements, and only detracted from the Jewish defense activity. Their much publicized immigration endeavors were minute and devoted mainly to bringing in fascist compatriots. In conclusion, the discrepancies between the bold claims now being made by Begin and his party and their record of past performance in Palestine bear the imprint of no ordinary political party. This is the unmistakable stamp of a fascist party for whom terrorism against Jews, Arabs, and British alike, and misrepresentation are means, and as the leader state is the goal. In the light of the foregoing consideration, it is imperative that the truth about Mr. Begin and his movement be made known to this country. It is all the more tragic that the top leadership of American Zionism has refused to campaign against Begin efforts or even to expose to its own constituents the dangers to Israel from support to Begin. The undersigned, therefore, take this means a publicly presenting a few salient facts concerning Begin and his party, and of urging all concerned not to support this latest manifestation of fascism. And then what is underneath of it are some of America's leading Jewish physicians and intellects and others who signed this on December 2nd, 1948. And again, what I just read was a letter to the New York Times from Albert Einstein, Professor Albert Einstein. Now, when you look back at what Einstein did, and you looked at the fact that that he was able to say what he had to say, could you imagine anyone in America today who would, A, have anyone print such a letter, B, immediately they would be attacked by AIPAC and the Jewish lobby, members of Congress, they would become persona non grata. And yet that was one of the last times that someone stood up and took a look, objectively or not, it is for each person to determine. Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, it's a prophetic letter because he's talking about a minority movement in Israel back in 48. The Labor Party was predominant at that time. But what they are condemning as a movement and a tendency in Israel has become government and has permeated the society. That what was a fascist ideology of a particular elite has now been disseminated into the population as a whole, and the degree of hostility and aggressiveness against Palestinian has multiplied several times over, and it's not a gang now, it's the Israeli Defense Force that goes in and bulldozes Palestinian communities and houses and farms, and they are involved in a genocidal policy which is determined by the top leaders in the country, elected leaders. The idea that Netanyahu establishes, you can have competitive parties, you can have elections, and you can have a fascist policy directed against the Palestinians in the country. And I think this is really the way in which Israeli society has evolved out of the seeds of Begin's fascism of 48. It has become state policy, and it's been stated in all of the public pronouncements that Israel is a Jewish state, and they're insisting that it be considered such, that Palestinians don't belong in what they call Greater Israel, and they've been seizing their land continuously and will accelerate now as formal pronouncements by Netanyahu. So he is essentially the progeny of Begin and that fascist policy. Only now they call it democracy or Jewish democracy. And in Congress today, I think if Netanyahu read that script and pronounced it, I think they'd be jumping up and down like jumping jacks, clapping. And the reason is because they're on the payroll of the Israel lobby. Sheldon Adelson contributes millions of dollars in campaign contributions, and he has these congressmen eating out of his hand. And if it's not Adelson, it's Chaim Sabin or some other of the plutocrats who consider Israel really their country and the United States a milking cow, which provides Israel with vetoes in the UN for its war crimes, which supplies Israel with arms for its aggression, not only against Palestine, but Syria and other countries, Lebanon, for example. And they have bought the U.S. Congress and turned them into absolute sycophants and servile fools of a state which represents the 34th most important economy. No other country can secure a presence in the Joint Congress that can secure a platform in all the media, New York Times, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal. They fall over themselves to defend Israeli war crimes. And I think this has to do with the power and influence that the Israeli lobby has over Congress, but also its representatives in government. I don't think one can overstate this, that you have, for example, the Department of Commerce, the Central Bank, and the Trade Commissioner from Commerce Secretary, Yellen. What?
I'm not sure who he is.
Oh, okay. But I'm saying that representatives in government, the pressure groups outside, the financiers, the interlock with the media, it's a formidable force, even though electorally it's less than 2% of the voting public, but votes can be leveraged, and that's what's happened. And the parties, for example, the Republicans get close to 40% of their funding from the pro-Israelites, plus they get grassroots supporters among the Christian Zionists, and then the Democrats for years were 60% were financed by pro-Israel Jews. And so you find these formidable influences because, let's face it, Netanyahu doesn't have much to say. He's a very mediocre politician. He's a bit of a crank in many ways. He thinks he's got a Napoleonic complex. He's the butt of jokes in some of the critical press in Israel. But here he's painted as some very notable statesman, which if you listen closely to what he says and how he says it, he's a third-rate politician.
Let's go through some, let's break this into some segments. Why it's important to acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons but has never acknowledged it now, up until now. We just acknowledged it at the State Department, but before then no one would acknowledge it, yet they've signed no treaty as if somehow we should trust that they would never use it in any way except for the protection survival of Israel, yet everyone else in the world that has nuclear weapons, we want to know how many, we account for them, whether it's in Russia or the United States or South Africa. So we've made an exception to them. Now, on the other hand, if you look at the relationship that Israel has now with Saudi Arabia, and you look at the relationship Saudi Arabia has as the number one financial and physical supporter of terrorism in the Middle East, they do more to fund, train, and then put their fighters, including ISIS, into other countries because they know that they have enormous wealth. They just one contract, I think it was 2 years ago, was for $20 billion in weapons, and they're an absolute monarchy. They beheaded 88 of their own citizens in the last year, but we do not criticize them for beheading. Anyone who beheads should be criticized, and rightly so. With ISIS, we should criticize them, but why not them? We talk about women's rights, and Hillary Clinton talks about being a women's rights advocate, yet her foundation received millions of dollars from Saudi Arabia. We never challenge Saudi Arabia and how it treats its own citizens, that it has no democracy, that women are subjugated there and are treated less than human. And yet there is an association now between Israel and Saudi Arabia. So how in the world is the Middle East supposed to have any opportunity to heal itself, to work through its problems, if two groups of people there who are historic enemies are working together for a common goal, and we're not discussing that in the American media? You will not see that discussed. From there, I'd like for you to talk about the fact that there is a thriving challenge to a lack of democracy and its violations in Israel. There is a vital element within the press. There's a vital element within the intelligentsia, in academia, and activists. You would never know that if you heard Sean Hannity or the other individuals who will never be critical on any level. No matter what Israel does, it will always spin the story to make it that it was provoked, it was not Israel's fault. just like in the last destruction of 10,000 homes and making 100,000 people homeless in the last incursion, it was never saying anything ever that showed any sense of empathy or compassion for the average Palestinian citizen. I'm not talking about sympathy or understanding for a terrorist. I'm not talking about those who are equal in their capacity for destruction within the Palestinian movements. I'm talking about the average person. Nothing. You never see Bill Riley, Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Laura Ingraham. You never see Mark Levin going to Israel, visiting the West Bank, spending some time there, visiting Gaza, spending some time there, talking with people. They're invisible. When they go, it's always to be celebrated. So look at that aspect of media participating in the keeping the Middle East destabilized. And the only thing you hear on O'Reilly show is now super, super fascist war hawks. People come on, we need boots on the ground in Iraq and in Syria. We need to go in there and attack them. We need to attack Iran. We need to fight Iran. And you think, my God, we couldn't defeat the Taliban after the longest war in American history in Afghanistan. Nor could we defeat the insurgents and those who did not want us there and were fighting us in Iraq. Do you have any idea the size of the army of Iran, the size of the country, three times larger than Iraq, the number of people, nearly 80 million people, and exactly how are you going to defeat these people militarily? Do you have any idea the consequences of what would happen when they would be supported by Russia and China and India and other countries? And yet these people will come on there, some retired colonel or general or someone, and talk someone from the RAND Corporation or the Heritage Foundation or one of these other conservative think tanks promoting war. And when I look at this and I say, where's the journalist who's on there saying you're wrong on all these points and here's why? We don't hear that. It's they make these unilateral decisions to have only those who support their ultra-fascistic principles on the air. Your thoughts on these issues, please.
Well, it's very clear. I agree with what you've described. There is alternative media that you can read criticism and discussions of Israeli racism, colonialism. It's nuclear weapons has been an open secret, especially since Mordecai 20 years ago blew the whistle on that, and it's known, but it hasn't been acknowledged by the Israelis or the U.S. government. And I think you can't understand the U.S. response, whether it's the right-wing media, Fox News, or CNN, or Charlie Rose, unless you know the tribal loyalties, and that is very important. There's a kind of a superiority complex that we know what's best for our people. And this is a very pervasive idea, this ethnocentrism and Jewish chauvinism, which has deeply penetrated not only the millionaires and the operators of the media, but you have all the 52 major presidents of the major Jewish organizations in the United States that operate at the municipal and state level. And they are like a Stalinist organization. There's no questioning. There's no dissent. They get the party line from directly from Tel Aviv, and they transmit it into the United States down to the grassroots level. I know in upstate New York and in small communities, if an editor wrote something critical about the Israeli bombing of Gaza, the editors got visits from the prominent lawyers and doctors and dentists locally who threatened them. And it happens on the individual level. Professors that dare to criticize don't get tenure. We have the case of Norman Finkelstein, a former student of mine at DePaul, who lost his job despite publishing numerous books, scholarly reviewed books. And so is a kind of terror that's exercised at different levels, retaliation against elected officials who don't toe the line. Cynthia, what's her name? Cynthia, black woman in Georgia, who was
McKinney.
Cynthia McKinney. Cynthia McKinney. They poured in millions of dollars and set up a scarecrow candidate, and they drove her out. And I think we have to deal with this fact of grassroots McCarthyite terror that is the complement of the Congress people. Congressmen, people wet their pants and look around before they dare to say anything about Israel. But it's not only the leading congressmen, it's also media people, academic people. They are very morally cowed by this kind of gangsterism that pervades our society, and it's high time people took it into their hands. Now, in 2006, when I published my first major book on this, The Power of Israel in the United States, very few people were speaking out. Today, that's changed. And even in the Jewish community, there's been significant dissent and criticism. Not going too far, but Jewish Voices for Peace, for example, has been very active. It's still a minority movement. It doesn't have the financial clout nor the hundreds of full-time operatives and militants that go around banging on doors of congressional offices, but the cracks, the fissures are beginning to show, and the fact that the Kerry and company are continuing negotiations despite being blackjacked by Congress and Netanyahu. So they're doing it because there's a mass base. American people don't want to go to war again for Israel like we did in Iraq. If you look at the Iraq War, Wolfowitz, Feith, Scooter Libby, all of these lifetime Zionists in strategic positions, cooking the books, to inventing this whole idea, weapons of mass destruction. And then the reporter for the New York Times sending and getting dispatches from Israel and writing them up as a wartime correspondent and later shown to be journalistic fraud, propagandist. And I think this kind of deep entry and deep penetration is still operative today, but it's being challenged. We have people like Blumenthal and other writers who are calling into question, and this is hopeful. We're still fighting an uphill battle, but the voices are getting out. If it's true that 60 Democrats boycotted Netanyahu's speech, it's not much just to boycott and to do it on for reasons of protocol that the U.S. president wasn't consulted. But the fact of the matter is, Democrats were the jumping jacks of yesterday, and the fact that they abandoned the Congress at the time is a sign that they're not going to be a 99% loyalist anymore. Maybe 98%.
Let me just reintroduce people just coming across the dial. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, and you're listening to Professor James Petras. He is the Bartell Professor Emeritus in Sociology at Binghamton University in New York, and he has authored over an amazing number, 600 articles in professional journals, 60 books, and he is one of the world's leaders on speaking out on social injustice, wherever it may be. And he's won the Distinguished Service Award from the American Sociological Association and the Robert Kenney Award as well. Now, I want to shift gears here a bit, and that is we usually think that Israel's struggle with all of its neighbors is solely a matter of preservation and to continue its national sovereignty. This is what the mainstream media wants us to believe. Nevertheless, Israel's military contingent has dominated and essentially controls everything in Israel today, and all of its foreign domestic policies and actions against its neighbors and Palestinians in particular. You suggest there might be another plausible way to view this, and that is to understand that Israel may have imperial designs of its own, which would include challenging those people in the Gulf that it feels it does not want. Also explain to us the role Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states play in supporting and further advancing Washington and Israel's Middle East agenda and what that means.
Well, Israel has engaged in wars with all of its neighbors, and where it is not directly engaged, it's contracted the U.S. to engage in this war through its influentials in the United States. As I mentioned, the Iraq War, they're backing the terrorists in the Golan Heights, and from the Golan Heights, they're supplying them with arms, training, wounded terrorists are treated in Israeli hospitals, so they're very involved in the disruption of the Syrian economy and society. Their purpose isn't to colonize all of Syria or Iraq. It's to destroy any possible critics of its colonization of Palestine. So it's a policy of either rule or ruin. If we can't get a Shah in Iran, let's have the U.S. bomb Iran, weaken it, and undermine its capacity to raise the flag for Palestinian liberation and a new and a Palestinian state. So Israel is interested in a purely Jewish Greater Israel, which means eventually forcing all the Palestinians out of Israel, or at least to live in Batustans, or as a underprivileged minority, and that's the key. And then their wars are against all the adversaries of that policy. Saddam Hussein was a supporter and actually paid pensions to Israeli political prisoners' families. If there were Palestinians in jail, a check would come from Iraq to maintain that family. Iran has given a lot of support. Hezbollah is likewise a supporter of Palestinian rights. So all these countries are coalition governments that support Palestinian rights for a homeland, they are targeted. And once Egypt gave up and collaborated with Israel in undermining Palestinians, they became partners. Saudi Arabia is tremendously hostile to any expression of Arab nationalism. They are a parasitical family dictatorship that lives on oil rents. They never produced anything. They are 100 billionaires, billionaires of over 100 billion. They live under the protection of the United States. The U.S. has sort of hired guns for the Saudi and the United Arab Emirates the same way. And since they share a support for United States, they also are indirectly and directly linked with Israel in opposing nationalist movements in the Middle East. Whether they're Islamic nationalists, secular nationalists, doesn't matter.
Okay, I want to shift gears and turn our attention to the U.S.'s imperialist activities. There are some independent voices, such as yourself, who observe that the very foundations of the U.S. militaristic empire building is crumbling rapidly. Afghanistan is now the world's producer of heroin, largest in the world, and Iraq is in shambles and chaos. And how did Libya work out for the neocons, Hillary Clinton and the others who advocated it? Well, why don't you take a look at Libya before we invaded and Libya today? Which was better for the Libyan people? All right? The U.S. has failed to remove Assad in Syria. ISIS, for all practical purposes, has emerged as a globally unrecognized rogue nation. The coup the U.S. staged in Honduras has turned that country into a basket case. Regime change in several countries is simply at the debacle stage. Like, look at Yemen as an example. We have yet to witness what will happen to Ukraine, but it has placed the U.S. on course with a possible military confrontation with Russia. I doubt it, because the Russians don't see any advantage in war, because they build up a huge upper-middle class that has all the advantages, and those would be taken away. So when someone has something that they could be deprived of in their position of power, they generally impact those who are in power to say, hold on a second, before you go to war, what is the likely outcome that our homes, our cities would remain intact? Well, they won't. Well, then why go to war? And so we actually have some people around the world who think of the consequences and before they act. We don't seem to think ever of the consequences. If we did, we wouldn't have a million of our soldiers who came back suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and Gulf War syndrome. We wouldn't have had 23 veterans a day killing themselves, more than actually died in Iraq or Afghanistan. We wouldn't have hundreds of thousands of our troops who are now homeless, living in under bridges in other places in the United States, invisible because they no longer are of use. But ask all those people who volunteered to do this. It wasn't a conscription. They weren't told you must go serve. They volunteered for whatever reason. I'm sure more often than not because of poverty and opportunity for an education afterwards. But in any case, if they had a chance to see the entire picture of everything likely to happen, would we do it again? And in most cases, most people would certainly not want to do it again now that they see this. So what we're witnessing and what will happen around the world is that the people in control in the United States are simply out of control. They're insulated. They live in bubbles. They live in that cesspool of Washington, D.C. They live with all the think tanks. They live in association with the ideology of the rapturists and the Christian radical right, who are the American Zionists. So that's what we have to contend with. So I'd like you to take your time and explain to us what you perceive as the consequences of our military and regime change failures, or is it all part of a larger plan to spread instability? And then how do you explain the Obama's more recent friendly overtures towards Iran and Syria to negotiate and dialogue?
Well, I think it's very clear that the U.S. empire is organized around a concept of military aims. The idea of the U.S. is to establish military colonies, U.S. bases, malleable puppet governments, and to expand the military-industrial complex to undermine Israeli enemies. So this strategy, a military strategy, has no way of relating to the economies in this country. It's not like multinationals are going to go in after the U.S. Devastates Iraq and fragments the society and sets Shias against Sunnis. They're not going to invest in Afghanistan when the U.S. Tears apart the networks and organization of that society. The fabric of society is decimated. Well, what is the goal of the U.S.? I think the goal of the United States is military conquest, military bases, a huge mercenary army. Probably there are more mercenaries than actually former U.S. Army troops. So there's $100 billion military contractors that are deeply involved in shaping U.S. policy. So you have the convergence of militarists, Zionists, military contractors, military industries, all engaged in formulating the policies of the United States, which essentially is military. There's nothing economic. People used to say the wars in the Middle East were about oil. Oil contracts were on the table for Libya. Gaddafi was ready to sign over joint ventures with all the majors in Europe and the U.S., and the U.S. has destroyed, totally destroyed Libya. It set in motion terrorist gangs, gangsters, smugglers, terrorists, etc. And they got out. The U.S. is running. It's running out of Yemen because this military strategy has no social and economic foundations. That means we're intervening in Latin America with a coup, and the multinational U.S. corporations are going to be the first beneficiary, aligning themselves with Latin American businessmen and bankers, and ensuring some kind of stability and elite prosperity. But that kind of policy isn't operative. The U.S. goes into Syria and it's bombing the country into the Stone Age. It goes into Iraq and it's totally destroyed the fabric of a modern science-based economy. It's threatening Iran with sanctions that are undermining a very dynamic economy. So this isn't economic imperialism. This is military imperialism, and the goal is to set up as many bases and to have as many collaborative elites that are willing to serve U.S. Power interests. The U.S. is obsessed with the idea that what they call world leadership, which is being the sole unipolar empire in the world, and that's why they go into Ukraine. Ukraine is a basket case today. Their own governor admits that they have only enough funds to pay the postman and the public employees for 1 month. They got the begging cup out, and Ukraine wasn't the model society before, but it was relatively stable and functioning. Today, people don't get electricity. They can't afford to pay for their rent or buy their food. And the regime is asking for $40 billion to keep going. And who is running the country? The finance minister is a U.S. citizen who was involved in a big U.S. investment house. So this idea of building the Ukraine as an outpost of NATO is really the goal. And as a result of that, you had a rebellion in the eastern sections of people that don't want to be colonized. They don't want to be under the dictates of the IMF. They want to have trade with the U.S., with Europe, and with Russia. So the whole strategy from the Ukraine, Iraq, Afghanistan is a military strategy that destroys the fabric of society, the infrastructure, and puts in place puppet regimes which will abide by the U.S. military dominance.
All right, let's bring it back to the United States, because simultaneously, as our military ventures further deteriorate, here at home, the U.S. is rapidly transitioning into a full police state. If trends continue, it could eventually become a full militarized police state analogous to past regimes that gave birth to Stasi, Gestapo, Stalin's secret police, the Red Guard revolutionaries. Do you see any relationship between the buildup of a U.S. military-industrial complex, its failures, and now the domestic policing of all American citizens? And is there any relationship between empire building and a pacified population under constant watch and control?
Well, I think you put your finger on it. Imperialist wars, especially military wars, which are very costly in lives and in economic terms, the only way you can sustain it is by intimidating your population and constant threat of terrorism and using that as a justification for total espionage, total surveillance, total repression. I mean, they're just not spying. It's not a question of simply privacy that's being violated. It is our collective freedom to organize and to speak out as citizens and organize ourselves and present alternatives. So the growth of the police state parallels the militarization of U.S. foreign policy and the failure. The more you fail, the more you escalate, the more you need a police state at home to keep the dissent from spilling over. Let's remember a few years ago that Obama mouthed all the peace rhetoric, co-opted the peace movement, and then carried out more wars than any other president in the history of the United States. That was one of the great tragedies, that we had a viable opposition, unfortunately got sucked into the Democratic Party and lost its bearings, and we haven't recovered it since. But remember, we had huge movement against the bailout of Wall Street, the Occupy Wall Street movement, and that was repressed and decimated. But there's constant coming forth of opposition movements that surround the economy, but an economy that's derived from a war effort that is very costly and unproductive and undermining the U.S. The U.S. says, we're going to surround China. None of the countries that the U.S. tries to round up are willing to isolate China because it's a dynamic economy that doesn't have the kind of massive military spending that the U.S. has. It doesn't have bases all over the world. They don't have bases outside of China. So the U.S. fails in its so-called turn to Asia. The Chinese set up an infrastructure bank. The U.S. says, we're not joining it. And then England turns around, France, Italy, now Korea is going to do it. The Australians, all the U.S. allies, suddenly joining China and leaving Obama's White House and Congress hanging.
Well, I believe that within the next 3 to 5 years, China will become the number one economy in the world. And with it, there will be a mixed currency as the reserve currency. The yuan will be one, but so will probably 6 or 7 other currencies, all backed by gold. China has a minimum of 30,000 tons of gold. Russia has close to that. The United States would be lucky to get one-tenth of that because we keep lending out the same gold over and over again, and most people are not aware that we don't have the gold reserves we once had. So at the end of the day, where the dollar is extremely strong today, especially against, for example, the euro, which has hit its one of its lowest points, and the Canadian dollar is down, ours is backed by nothing. We have a fiat currency. We spent over $3 trillion in quantitative easing to help the banks. We didn't help any company, small company or taxpayer. We didn't help bail out any student. We didn't forgive any student debt. We didn't forgive any of the 500% payday loans that were delinquent. No, we just increased debtors' prisons in 27 states, made it illegal to feed homeless people in 60 cities, and somehow had the temerity to call ourselves humanistic in some level. So my final issue is what Chris Hedges recently said. This is from Truthdig, quote, journalism as subversion. The assault of global capitalism is not only an economic and political assault, it is a cultural and historical assault. Global capitalism seeks to erase our stories and our histories. Its systems of mass communication, which peddle a fake intimacy with manufactured celebrities and a false sense of belonging within a mercenary consumer culture, shut out our voices and hopes and dreams. Salacious gossip about the elites and entertainers, lurid tales of violence and inane trivia, replace in national discourse the actual and the real. The goal is a vast historical amnesia. The traditions, rituals, and struggles of the poor and working men and working women are replaced with the vapid homogenization of mass culture. Life's complexities are reduced to simplistic stereotypes. Common experience centers around what we have been fed by television and mass media. We become autonomized and alienated. Solidarity and empathy are crushed. The cult of the self becomes paramount. And once the cult of the self is supreme, we are captives to the corporate monolith. As the mass media, now uniformly in the hands of large corporations, turn news into a ridiculous chronicling of pseudo-events and pseudo-controversy, we become ever more invisible as individuals. And any reporting of the truth about what the powerful are doing to us, and how we are struggling to endure and retain our dignity and self-respect would fracture and divide a global population that must be molded into compliant consumers and obedient corporate subjects. Your final thoughts on the fact that our American media has become this.
I agree with the cultural criticism. I made the same kind of criticisms over the last 40 years. But the point is that the most significant development is the militarization of the U.S. empire building. That's the key. The cultural manipulation is a way of distracting people from the drive for permanent wars, total wars that are very costly to the American public. Standard of living is declining. We recognize here in upstate New York that probably close to 50% of the white children are living below the poverty line. There is immense growth of inequality in the United States. The bonuses on Wall Street, the 160,000 employees on Wall Street, make more than all the American people that are working for the minimum wage. I mean, this is a banana republic, especially New York City, when we're talking about the distribution of empire.
Professor Petrus, I'm going to invite you back for the solutions. We've laid out the problems, and I feel that you have given us some extremely important insights into the nature of U.S. empire, both abroad and here at home, and its impact upon world and American citizens. Now in our next discussion, we will look at what can we individually and collectively do to turn this around for those who are progressive and looking for the truth and looking for good ways of dealing with these issues. We can do this. I'm confident we can do it. I do not look at this fatalistically. I believe that we have a lot of options. So I look forward to our next conversation.
Okay, Gary, very good. I agree with you. We have to put on the table the real options that exist.
My guest for our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, Professor James Petrus, P-E-T-R-A-S, the Bartol Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University, and one of the world's leading voices on U.S. interference in global politics, especially Latin America and the Middle East. And he has been commenting a long time on social issues, workers' rights, and was a member of the Bertrand Russell Tribunal on Repression in Latin America. His book is The Politics of Empire, the U.S., Israel, and the Middle East, and his website is lahaine.org/Petrus. I'll end with this from Albert Einstein again. The world will not be destroyed by those who do evil, but by those who watch them without doing anything. Albert Einstein. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on the next program.